The High Court is entering the final month of the session, and at this point, justices are expected to announce decisions on the first day of every work week between now and the end of June, and then adjourn for the summer. We're getting a preview of the pending high-profile cases here on The Morning Show, gathering your questions along the way. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The justices will be handing down decisions on gerrymandering, unions, gay rights, abortion, and President Trump's travel ban. Let's bring in Ryan Owens for analysis. He's a professor of political science and affiliate law faculty here at UW-Madison. He's an expert on the High Court. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So from a political perspective, how big of a term is this for the U.S. Supreme Court? Because it seems like we've had some pretty major decisions coming down the pike. Give us some perspective.
Well, this is one of the most interesting terms we've had in a long time for the court. Of course, last year, you know, with the court split 4-4, I think it was pretty reluctant to take on too many hot-button issues. But that reluctance is surely gone. We've got a number of big cases coming up yet to be decided. We've had a few already. But, you know, as you said, we've got redistricting. We've got, cell tower information. We've got issues involving public unions and abortion. There's just a lot of cases this term. It's really going to be, I think, one of the more important and critical terms that we've seen from the court in a long time.
Well, before we look at these pending cases, let's take a little bit of a look back here. We've already had some rulings from the court come down so far, like sports betting, one involving Wisconsin's own Epic Systems. But it's probably fair to say that the court leaves the most contentious and high-profile cases for closer to the end of the term. But that being said, have you been surprised at all with some of the rulings that have already come down?
Not really. I mean, I think generally you're correct that the major cases tend to be decided or released, I should say, in June at the very end of the court's term. But I think most of the cases that have been decided so far have gone more or less the way a lot of people had expected it to go. You know, I think the case that you mentioned before, the sports betting case, I think most people who listened to oral argument there, I think, anticipated that outcome. It wasn't as huge as a lot of people suggested. For example, it didn't authorize betting in all states, as a lot of people had sort of reported erroneously. All it did was tell Congress that you cannot prohibit the states from doing something with sports betting. If you want to get involved with this, Congress, you can go ahead, pass a law, say that, you know, you're going to regulate it this way or that. But they didn't actually do that in that case. They just told states that states couldn't do that. And the Supreme Court found that to be an affront to state sovereignty and violated what it called the anti-commandeering principle, which is that Congress can't basically tell states what to do. Congress has to do it itself.
And then last Monday, or I guess 2 Mondays, if you want to count the holiday, Epic Systems versus Lewis came down, the Supreme Court upholding companies' rights to make forced arbitration a condition of employment. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts there? Was that pretty major?
Well, we'll have to see. I know a lot of people have suggested that it could be really, really important. We'll see what employers do now. If you see more and more employers building these into their contracts, it's something that could become a little bit more significant. And of course, I think as the court recognized, I mean, this is a statutory interpretation question. And I think many people have argued that Justice Gorsuch's interpretation based on the text of the statutes was correct. But as a policy matter, if Congress dislikes the court's decisions, it can always draft a new law that puts a different interpretation on it that would be a little bit more clear in terms of whether arbitration is part of the collective bargaining agreement.
So push back legislatively through Congress is always an option.
Yeah, for these statutory interpretation questions, that's right. That's absolutely right.
Well, let's look what's coming up here. The court heard two cases related to partisan gerrymandering this session, including Gill versus Whitford, considering whether Wisconsin's map was drawn to unfairly benefit Republicans. Let's start there. What's the story behind this case?
Well, so every 10 years, states have to redistrict. They have to take a census and find out how many people live there, right? Because under the Constitution, we have to apportion seats across the country based on population. And so every 10 years, basically, states have to reevaluate what their population is and then sort of adjust the borders of their districts accordingly. So if you've lost population, probably going to lose a seat in Congress. If you've gained population, you're likely to gain another seat in Congress, and you have to create new district boundaries to figure out where those new members are going to be. And in the process of that, legislatures have a tendency to want to benefit people of their own party. So whoever is in the majority tends to draw the districts so that their majority kind of withstands contentious elections in the future, try to sort of pad your majority status up a little bit. And the question in this case is whether or not that unconstitutionally violates either your due process rights or whether it violates your First Amendment rights. And, you know, it's an interesting question. I think on the policy sort of merits of it substantively, I think a lot of people are very sympathetic to the argument that, you know, we can't have these gerrymandered districts because it just pulls the parties further and further to the left and to the right, and, you know, the middle gets left out. And so I think, but that's a separate question relative to the legal question and the constitutional one. Do we want courts to be involved with this, and what kind of standards are courts going to be able to adopt, and are courts actually the best institutional actors to be setting the boundaries here? So these are all questions that are being sort of drug up in this case.
Ryan Owens is our guide here as we look at U.S. Supreme Court cases that rulings are going to be coming down in the next weeks. We're getting a preview. Ryan Owens is a political science professor at UW-Madison and faculty affiliate in the law school. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. What Supreme Court case currently has your attention? How would you like to see the court rule on the cases involving issues of political gerrymandering that we're talking about, religious liberty and the president's travel ban? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Ryan, Gill versus Whitford and the Maryland case, do those have repercussions, political line drawing? Could that determine which party controls Congress and many state legislatures in the decades ahead? I mean, aren't there huge ramifications here?
Yeah, I think there could be really huge ramifications for this case. At first, I was a little skeptical, but you know, the more you read about it, the more you listen, you know, you take a look at the law on this, it could be pretty significant. Now, before we get into that, though, I should say, if you take a look at all of the cases that were heard in October, so there were nine of them, the court tends to assign opinions relatively equally, so each justice will typically get a majority opinion to write for that particular sitting or that month. And in the month of October, every single opinion that the court heard has been decided except for Gill. And if you take a look at who's written all of those opinions, everyone has written except for Chief Justice Roberts. So that would strongly suggest that Roberts is the one who has the majority opinion in the Gill case. Now, what that means is unclear, right? It could be that he's part of, say, a 5-4 coalition that includes Kennedy, or it could mean that he's part of a 6-3 coalition that's actually more liberal, and it includes Kennedy, and Roberts kept the case to himself to write in order to kind of water it down a little bit. You know, it's difficult to predict at this point, but having Roberts being the one likely that's writing the opinion is going to be quite different than if someone like Kennedy or another justice would be writing it.
So what happens if the court says, yes, these maps are unfair? Where do we go from there? Or if the court says, no, we're not, you know, these maps are fine?
Yeah, it's tough to say. It's all going to come down in what kind of remedy they fashion. Now, of course, you know, the court doesn't seem to be in a particular hurry to decide these cases. Of course, they granted a stay of the lower court's decision here in Wisconsin. And if you take a look at the case out of Maryland during oral arguments, justices were pretty interested in, you know, what an injunction would mean and, you know, how quickly they could get to things in the legislature if the court rendered a decision. So they don't seem to be particularly motivated about getting something done by the 2018 elections. You know, and given that, that might indicate something to us that essentially all they're going to do is adopt some sort of a broad standard, much like they've done in the past.
We are looking at decisions coming down the pike as the justices head into the final month of this session. Ryan Owens is our guide. He's a political science professor here at UW-Madison, faculty affiliate in the law school. You can join in with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. What Supreme Court case currently has your attention? How would you like to see the court rule on these cases involving issues such as Gill versus Whitford, political gerrymandering, religious liberty, and the president's travel ban? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this latest news here on the Ideas Network. The ideological divisions on the Supreme Court will be tested in the coming weeks with pending cases involving partisan gerrymandering, unions, gay rights, and the president's travel ban. Meanwhile, at the box office, the documentary RBG is drawing audiences. It looks at the life and career of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is 85. It's grossed millions of dollars. We've got an hour on the high court cases, the personalities, the ideological distinctions here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the bench and the big screen, Ryan Owens is watching it all as a political science professor at UW-Madison and an expert on the high court. You can join in with your questions and your insights, 800-642-1234. What ruling are you most anticipating? What are the political ramifications do you see coming from any one of these rulings? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan, so this is your breakthrough moment, my friend. You could become a movie critic. Have you seen RBG?
No, I've not, surprisingly,
man.
Here. So there goes that line of questioning right there.
Do you plan to see it?
Oh, I may.
Okay.
I don't find it all that helpful when we actually really sort of like prop justices up as rock stars.
Oh, come on. You've shared the meme, Notorious RBG.
Yeah.
But what about that? I mean, why? There's a lot of people going to this documentary. What is the interest in this justice?
Well, I mean, I do think that the justices themselves tend to be pretty quiet. They tend to be pretty reserved. They're not out on the hustings all that much, although, of course, that is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people sort of want information about the justices. Who are they? You know, what do they do? And Justice Ginsburg is, you know, the longest-standing liberal on the court right now. And so I think, you know, she's attracting attention from people who are energized on the left.
Well, it was interesting. Last Monday, she took the uncommon step of reading aloud her dissent on the Epic Systems versus Lewis ruling that favors employers over employees in arbitration proceedings. Was that unusual?
Well, not particularly.
Okay.
Justices tend to, you know, when they do dissent, they often read a summary of their dissent from the bench. But yeah, if they're especially ticked off about something, they will read the entire dissent from the bench. And then you know that they're really exercised about something.
Well, let's look at this next case, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. At issue in this case is this idea of religious liberty, more specifically that a business owner shouldn't have to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple if it violates the owner's religious beliefs. Can you break down this one for us?
Sure. Yeah, in this case, actually came off more on compelled association than it did on religious liberties, although there's certainly a strong amount of that here. So basically what happened is the individual who owned the Masterpiece Cake Shop was he was a pretty religious guy. He wasn't open on Sundays. He didn't make cakes for Halloween. He wouldn't put alcohol in cakes. So he was a fairly religious guy and held to his beliefs. A gay couple came in and said that they wanted to purchase a cake, and he sat down with them at the table, and they started looking at things, and then they mentioned that it was for their wedding, and he said, well, you know, I'm sorry, I don't do same-sex weddings. And so they got up and left, and of course, the next day, then I think one of the two of them, their mother called in and said, you know, why won't you serve, my son? And he said, look, I just don't do same-sex marriages. You know, you can purchase any cake from our store that's already made, but I'm not going to actually make. I'm not going to lend my expressive conduct towards your cake because I don't agree with the message of same-sex marriage. And that's really what this is all about here right now, I think, at least as it's framed at the Supreme Court, is whether for someone like a cake maker or someone else who uses his or her artistic abilities to create something, whether from their perspective they can be compelled to create something for a same-sex marriage with which they disagree.
And Colorado, like California and 20 other states, requires businesses that are open to the public to provide, quote, full and equal service to all customers, regardless of sexual orientation. So this is where we look into perhaps the owner may have been a victim of bias against religion?
Well, that's certainly what he's claiming, and okay. That's what others have claimed as well. And if you listen to the oral argument, it seems like that actually got some play with Justice Kennedy. He said to the attorney for the state of Colorado, he said, you know, counsel, tolerance works best when it works both ways, and it doesn't seem as though the state here has been either tolerant or respectful to the cake baker's religious beliefs. And Kennedy is going to be critical to this. I think pretty much everyone agrees this is likely to be a 5-4 decision. Mm. And Kennedy's vote will be incredibly important. And again, if you look at the breakdown, so all of the December cases have been decided already and written, except for the Masterpiece Cake Shop case and the Carpenter case, which deals with privacy rights with cell site tower location information. And the only two justices to have not written from that sitting are Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy. So it's likely, in my mind, that Kennedy is going to be writing the opinion in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. And given what he said during oral argument, he seems to be very troubled by what the state of Colorado did in the case.
And this isn't the first time that a religious liberty case has come before the Supreme Court. Where have justices fallen on this in the past?
Well, they've been, in recent terms, more sympathetic towards those who are claiming infractions to their religious liberties. So you had the Hobby Lobby case, you had mm-hmm. the Little Sisters of the Poor case, and others where justices seem to be skeptical of what some might say is, you know, government intrusions on their religious interests. And so, if this case comes off like those cases, I think you'd see a 5-4 in favor of the cake shop. Now, the question for the court is going to be, how can you write an opinion that is sympathetic, cognizant to religious liberty interests, but at the same time doesn't open up lots of issues that involve, you know, serving folks in a public service sector? So, you know, are people going to be able to take the court's opinion and say, well, I don't want to serve African Americans or I don't want to serve Hispanics, and, you know, base those decisions on the court's opinion? So my guess is the court's going to probably try to carve out a very limited exception here and say for professions that involve, you know, extreme amounts of, you know, individualistic artistic expression, such as artists, photographers maybe, and the like, you can't be compelled to associate with individuals or messages with which you disagree.
So it's not overly broad in the implications in our world, is that right?
Yeah, they're going to be very, very concerned about that as they write the opinion.
Matt from Wausau emailed and said the installation of Neil Gorsuch was the most flagrant example of disregard for the will of the people in decades. The refusal to confirm not only President Obama's choice for Supreme Court, but hundreds of appointments to lower courts skewed our democracy to the minority. So how would you respond to Matt there and the appointment of Neil Gorsuch?
Well, I mean, the appointment of judges historically has been pretty political. You know, it's if you look at the data on this, it's pretty clear that that it's been a political process for a long time. It just seems to be that politics these days is just infecting everything to a rather unfortunate degree. In terms of lower court appointments, I think President Trump has had about as much luck as President Obama did on many instances. I mean, his lower court nominees have been obstructed to about the same degree. But in terms of Neil Gorsuch, you know, it's tough to say with that one. It was certainly unprecedented that you would hold the seat vacant for a full year. You know, at the same time, Senate Democrats were on record as having said that they would have done the same exact thing to President George H.W. Bush in 1991, 1992. You know, what I worry about is what happens next. You know, these things have a tendency to be a one-way ratchet. So what happens next? I mean, if Democrats take over, then are they going to expand the size of the court to try to, you know, counteract the Gorsuch addition? I've heard rumblings of that. You know, it's not a good thing when we keep continually pushing things. It just has this one-way ratchet effect.
I thought it was interesting last week when Justice Ginsburg accepted an award from the American Law Institute that she called for a return to the bipartisan spirit that used to prevail in Congress during judicial confirmations. And she said, quote, "My hope is that one fine day Congress will return to the bipartisan spirit that prevailed for my nomination." So certainly justices are feeling this as well.
Well, that's absolutely true. And, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, right around the time of the Gorsuch nomination, made the point that, you know, when the public sees the court as being political, when we have senators drawing these hard lines about nominees and, you know, interest groups running ads, it has a tendency to reduce the legitimacy, the perceived legitimacy of the court. And there's some evidence to suggest that that's the case. Now, whether you're going to change that at any point soon, you know, I'm dubious of that. It's just not likely to happen. The ironic thing is, as the Supreme Court has become more and more involved in our daily lives, Supreme Court nominations have become more and more important. So, you know, just as justices want more power, they're also saying, oh, it should be more bipartisan. Well, you know, you can't have it both ways.
Talking with UW-Madison political scientist Ryan Owens, looking at the decisions coming down in the coming weeks as the nine justices wrap up the session. You can join in with your observations, your questions about cases, 800-642-1234. What Supreme Court case currently has your attention, and how would you like to see the court rule on the cases involving the issues of political gerrymandering, religious liberty, and the president's travel ban? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Well, let's take a look at the travel ban, and this one certainly being closely scrutinized, Ryan. Various federal courts have ruled against the president's policy. Some think the Supreme Court may be a bit more kind to it. And then late last year, the court allowed the ban to go into effect while legal challenges against it continue. So where do we stand here on the travel ban?
Well, so the case has been orally argued, and the justices are, you know, putting together the opinion right now. It should probably be released within a couple of weeks. You know, I tend to agree with the observers that you mentioned earlier that said the Supreme Court seems to be more sympathetic to this. I think federal courts are just in a really awkward position here. They don't want to get into some kind of a system where they've got to look at the foreign policy, you know, the intelligence that's going on, like what the president sees. They're just not in a position to do that and to make judgments about whether what he did was appropriate or not. And so, you know, there's a real hesitance there, I think, on the part of the court, not to mention just the fundamental separation of powers issues involved with it. So I think that justices are going to do what they can to, you know, maybe decide this as limited as they possibly can. I think, however, that the executive branch is probably in a better position here than the challengers are.
And this is Trump versus Hawaii. Remind us how Hawaii took the lead on this.
Well, I mean, what you're seeing here is sort of the flip side of what you saw during the Obama administration, where you know, the president adopts some kind of a nationwide policy with which litigants disagree. And so they go to either a liberal or a conservative district court judge, and they try to get a nationwide injunction blocking the president's policy. So we saw that happen. Conservatives did that to President Obama's immigration policy when they went forum shopping in Texas. And, of course, liberals are doing this in California and in Hawaii. So, you know, their claim is that, you know, they have citizens who are, you know, tied to these nationals from foreign countries who want to come here, and they're being damaged because the other people can't come here. They've got universities in their state that want scholars to come over, but they can't come over, and so they're being damaged in that capacity. And so that's the sort of the jurisdictional hook that gets them into federal courts. And then once they're just saying that the president is violating statutory law in terms of immigration policy. They believe that Congress has the authority to set the policy here, and that Congress has basically rendered a policy decision that's inconsistent with what the president wants. And they're making a second claim that this violates the Establishment Clause, that the president, because he, as they put it, is targeting Muslims, is essentially violating the Establishment Clause. You can't establish a federal religion.
Well, critics of the president also say his campaign trail rhetoric about barring Muslims from entering the U.S. should be taken into account when weighing this case. So should the justices be considering that rhetoric?
Well, I guess two things. First is that, you know, the court did not consider that rhetoric from President Obama when he swore up and down that it was a penalty and not a tax when he was talking about the Obamacare policy he wanted to put forward. It's a penalty, not a tax, a penalty, not a tax. We heard that over and over and over again. And yet when they went to the Supreme Court, they said, no, it's a tax, not a penalty. And the justices didn't call them out on that inconsistency. So I think that precedent has kind of been set already, that that the Supreme Court is disinclined, at least, to look at campaign rhetoric. The other thing is the Solicitor General made the argument, and I'm not sure how much sway this is going to have with the justices, but the Solicitor General made the argument that once the president takes the oath of office, everything has changed. So you might be saying all kinds of things on the campaign trail, but once you take the oath of office, it's sort of a transformation, right? Now, it's exceedingly formalistic,
right.
And it may be correct. I'm not sure how much sway that's going to have over the justices, though.
Let's bring in Jeff with a question in River Falls. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in the issue of whether or not the Supreme Court and their opinions are more of a shaper or a mirror, that long-lasting question about the Supreme Court of social mores. Do they shape us or do they just sort of reflect who we are? I wonder if the professor has a case in mind from this term or the last couple of three, or maybe even one that's on the horizon, like a Roe versus Wade or a Tinker Des Moines or Brown versus Board of Education, a landmark case that we're likely to be talking about 10 years from now, 20 years, maybe even a century from now.
Jeff, thanks for that question. Ryan, shaper or mirror of us?
Well, it is a good question, and the evidence on this suggests that the court does tend to go with public opinion. It tends to track public opinion, not all the time. Of course, there are some exceptions to that, as the caller pointed out. But we do know that justices are concerned about public opinion. We know that they pay attention to it, that they tend to follow it. And when they render decisions that are inconsistent with public opinion, they tend to do things like write them more clearly to explain why they've ruled inconsistent with public opinion. So they surely do care about it, and I think that's the answer to that first part. The answer to the second one, though, In terms of,
I'm going to have to pause right there to the answer to the second part of that question. We're with UW-Madison political scientist Ryan Owens as our guide this hour. 800-642-1234. What's on your mind as the Supreme Court makes rulings here in the coming weeks? We'll get back to the conversation after this latest news update here on the Ideas Network. The U.S. Supreme Court is in the height of decision season with less than 4 weeks to go in this session. We're anticipating some high-profile decisions coming down in June. A few facts to throw out into the conversation. The average age on the 9-member court is 69, and Supreme Court justices tend to serve well beyond normal retirement years. Currently, court observers are wondering about a retirement with 81-year-old Anthony Kennedy, who has thought about retirement in the past. It is All Things High Court here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ryan Owens is our guide. He's a political science professor and faculty affiliate at the law school at UW-Madison. Gathering your questions and insights there, welcome at 800-642-1234. What high court decision are you anticipating? Will it have consequences on your life? And what political consequences do you see coming from the rulings? Join in by phone. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ryan, before we move on to the next call, let's go back to Jeff's question and answering the second part of it. He was looking at whether the Supreme Court shapes society or is a reflection of who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And the second part of his question, I think, was, you know, do you see any major questions coming up now where the court maybe gets out in front of an issue?
Mm-hmm, like a Roe v. Wade-ish. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, there are a lot of really big cases this term, but there's one case in particular that is maybe flying under the radar a little bit, although it has received some attention, and that's the Carpenter versus United States. And that's a case that involves whether or not the governor, the government, needs a search warrant to get information about where you've traveled with your cell phone. So, you know, when you move from one location to another, the cell towers can determine where you are, right? So your phone is constantly pinging with whatever tower is closest to it. And so the government can actually contact your cellular provider and say, hey, you know, we want information on, you know, Owens. Where has he been over the last month or so? And they will give the government that information, typically. And the government can then use that to make a case against you about, you know, maybe you were at a certain spot at a certain point in time, and use that to corroborate their findings. And the question in this case is whether or not the government should be required to get a search warrant to obtain that information. Now, technically speaking, it is the property of your cellular provider, right? Mm. You purchase the phone, they have the property of the data for where you travel. But as we have become, you know, more and more reliant on cellular information, you know, as Justice Kennedy would say, now that we're in the cyber age, you know, this issue is actually becoming quite a bit more important. So not too long ago, the Chief Justice wrote an opinion for a unanimous court that said that police have to get a search warrant if they want to search your phone. Like, they have to do it. And we'll see what happens with this case. I wouldn't be surprised if they actually go a step further now and say that police may need to get a search warrant for this type of information. That will be an interesting case, and it could have some ramifications for technology in the future.
It seems, too, that privacy advocates on the right and the left are perhaps agreeing about something.
I think that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's take another call out now. Let's go to David joining us from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hey, morning. Yeah, we're just getting dawn out here. let's see. 25 years ago, in the early 90s, when Newt Gingrich was king of Congress, he put together some bad law that the Supreme Court just ruled on last week, and that's the sports gambling one. And so Newt's bad law it basically gave Las Vegas the exclusive rights to gambling on sports, even though they banned it in the United States in its entirety. So now, last week, the Supreme Court has ruled that, oh, the poor 49 states, they have to have the right to gamble too. So So this was the camel's nose under the tent under Newt, and so the Supreme Court has just opened the tent wide. And this is such bad law that it's basically devastating to the economy, and I wonder if your guests have got comments on it.
David, thanks for bringing the sports betting case to the table. Ryan, go ahead.
Yeah, so just a couple of factual matters. So the PAPSA, the Professional Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992, this, of course, was passed in 92, and Newt Gingrich didn't take over until 1995, so you can't lay that at his feet. This was actually also called the Bradley Act, named after Bill Bradley, Democratic senator from New Jersey. The other factual matter is it's not correct to say that this banned it from all the other states. In fact, there were some provisions in that act as originally passed that would have allowed a handful of other states to get sort of a waiver, an exception, and be able to have gambling. New Jersey was one of them. New Jersey elected at the time, however, not to exercise that right. And so there were a couple other states in there. So this is, it wasn't lined up just to benefit Las Vegas. So given all of those sort of factual clarifications, I'm not sure where to go else with this other than to say I think the court's decision was pretty consistent with what it's decided in recent years, that the federal government can't just tell states, you can't do this, right, unless the federal government wants to do it as well. So there's something in the Constitution called the Supremacy Clause, and it says that the federal law is supreme, notwithstanding any state court decision or state law. And so if the federal government decides to do something, the states have to basically sort of go along with it so long as the federal government has jurisdiction over the matter. Well, what the federal government did in this case is it didn't say that we're going to regulate gambling. What it did was it said, states, you can't regulate gambling. Right. And that was a problem for the court because essentially you've got the national government telling states that are sovereign entities that they cannot do something, even though the federal government chose not to do it. Mm. Right. So if the feds would have come in and said, we are regulating gambling, then any state law that was contrary to that would have fallen by the wayside. But that's not what the federal government did. It just said, we're not going to get involved with this, but you can't get involved with it either. And that was problematic from a constitutional perspective.
David, thanks. Let's go to Tom. Tom, who's joining us from Port Wing. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning. I was wondering if the professor could highlight some of the Supreme Court reversals, starting with, like, Dred Scott, and proving the fallibility of the Supreme Court.
That's reaching way back here and certainly going a little bit away from our theme of pending cases. Ryan, any insights there on reversals?
Well, I actually didn't hear the caller's question in terms of what case got reversed. But, the Supreme Court, in terms of reversing lower courts, tends to do so about 65% of the time. We know petitioners win about 65% of the time on average at the court. So if you're just sort of, playing the odds on whether a case gets reversed or affirmed, you can usually think reversal.
Okay. Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I was going to mention one court case and one point. The court case that I'm paying close attention to is about the gerrymandering in Wisconsin because I live here, and I'd like us to have democracy back rather than rigged elections for the legislature. The point I was going to make is that I'm not sure, but I think you, with the 1991, your guest was referring to the supposed Biden rule, except that was a lie made up by Republicans to excuse the unprecedented nature of what they did with the open Supreme Court seat. If you go back and look at what Biden actually said, he was arguing for decreasing the amount of partisanship in judicial picks by not allowing partisan judges to do a quick retirement to get replaced by a sitting administration rather than allow, and that way prevent an incoming administration from having its picks.
All right.
And this would be quick retirement at the end of the election year, not the beginning. What the Republicans did was misrepresent what Biden was talking about.
Nate, let's let Ryan jump in here as we circle back to partisan gerrymandering, Gill versus Whitford.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people actually share that sort of gut feeling about wanting to make sure that districts are as competitive as possible, because, you know, as it is right now, if you're a Democrat or a Republican, right, you're more worried in many of these districts with being primaried by somebody to your left or somebody to your right. And so that has an incentive to want to push you further to the right or to the left. And I think, you know, a lot of people think that's becoming problematic, and you know, our government is not able to accomplish what it needs to accomplish because of that. I think actually most people have at least some feeling in that capacity. I think most people sort of get that. The question is, though, you know, who is the right actor to deal with that situation? Who is most institutionally equipped to handle that situation? Is it a court? Is it a legislature? Is it some independent body? I think a lot of people are very concerned that if the courts get involved with this, it's going to sort of cast them in an unfavorable light, or they will, you know, for lack of a better expression, screw it up. So, you know, there's all kinds of moving parts here. And I think even if most people kind of get the concern about gerrymandering, the question then becomes, well, who decides, right? Mm. Who makes those decisions? And that's really, I think, where the rubber meets the road.
Well, as we start to wrap up here, there have been rumblings about a retirement on the high court. It's been speculated that Anthony Kennedy may retire this summer, perhaps, after the term ends. Is there any sense? Do you know anything there?
Yeah, we all sort of wonder about what's going to happen here. From what I've heard, actually, Kennedy was pretty seriously considering retiring last year, and then he had that 30-year reunion with his clerks and his birthday party. Everybody expected him to retire, but what I've heard is that he actually changed his mind and decided not to retire. You know, I wouldn't be shocked if he does retire at this point. He's been on the court for a very long time. He's the longest-serving justice on the court right now, and at 81, you know, it's probably time.
He was nominated to the court in 87 by President Reagan.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, you remember he was Reagan's third choice for the pick. I wouldn't be shocked if he retires. On the other hand, you know, he is the swing justice. He has, you know, every single case we're talking about, where is Kennedy? And, you know, that kind of power is enticing for many people. And you know, for him in particular, I mean, he really relishes that role of being the centrist justice that everybody has to go after. I think he really likes that position. So
we'll watch it just like you are.
Yep, that's right.
Ryan Owens, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
Ryan Owens is a professor of political science and affiliate law faculty at UW-Madison, an expert on the U.S. Supreme Court. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer provided technical support. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.